this week's program, a conversation with Michael Tilson Thomas. The music director of the San Francisco Symphony conducts the Philadelphia Orchestra in concerts this week. Jason Pfeiffer previews the Philadelphia Improv Festival, an annual event that highlights the growth in unscripted comedy in the region. David Patrick Stearns profiles Philadelphia virtuosi, and Susan Lewis visits the Sketch Club and the Plastic Club on Philadelphia's Camac Street, dubbed the Avenue of the Artists. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
This week, Michael Tilson Thomas guest conducts the Philadelphia Orchestra in a program featuring Aaron Copland's Symphony for Organ and Orchestra with soloist Paul Jacobs and Mahler's Symphony No. 5. Tilson Thomas has conducted the Philadelphia Orchestra more than 20 times over the past three decades at the Mann Center for the Performing Arts and the Saratoga Performing Arts Center, but this is the first time he leads the ensemble in a subscription concert. Michael Tilson Thomas is music director of the San Francisco Symphony and the founder and artistic director of the New World Symphony in Miami. He's also the principal guest conductor of the London Symphony Orchestra. Over the course of his now almost 40-year career, Tilson Thomas has conducted many of the world's greatest orchestras, and when we met backstage at the Kimmel Center earlier this week, I first asked him what he felt his role was when standing in front of an orchestra as guest conductor.
The way I think of myself as a conductor is a little bit in the role of director slash coach, something like this. And what a director does, or a director works with different casts of people who are great. They are great people. They have amazing abilities. And the director tries to give them some possibilities of using their essentially great qualities to still perhaps greater advantage, more effective advantage. Because when people are in the midst of the ensemble situation, they, in their absorption of doing all they have to do, perhaps don't see that they really should be taking a little bit more time over here, or perhaps they should be giving one of their colleagues a little bit more room there, and you know that their roles are variously supporting one another or challenging one another or whatever it may be could be perhaps pointed up a bit more, which would give a more exciting shape to the entire proceedings and at the same time would be most essentially about the incredible communicative talent of those people who are actually giving the performance.
And you mentioned the word communicate. How do you communicate, or how do you learn how to communicate with a group of 100-plus musicians in the short space of time that you're going to spend with them?
Well, at this point in my life, I just kind of go for it. I just do it. You know, I just start talking about certain specific situations which relate to timing and rhythm and breathing, and certain things relate to tone quality. And a thing I like to do very much is that the orchestra contains people who have great careers as soloists and chamber musicians, and sometimes by referring them to music which they know from that other world, it can cause them to think about it differently and perhaps bring more personal qualities that they might be associating with that part of their lives more into what can happen in the orchestra.
And you talk about it being different casts, the Philadelphia Orchestra being your Philadelphia cast. Mm-hmm. You're in London, you're the principal guest mm-hmm. conductor there. Does your approach vary with the cast that's put in front of you?
Yes.
How so?
Because I have certain ideals of what the piece in its totality should be about. And with different ensembles, they have natural instincts which make different parts of that design instantly clear. So that I might hear in one orchestra that they have an astounding rhythmic organization, and another one that have amazing tonal lushness, and another one that has great variety of idiosyncratic wind players or whatever it might be, and also that the hall allows various things. So I'm saying, okay, well, all these things are already in focus. Maybe we can do more with some of these other qualities over here. Or perhaps if I, you know, suddenly realize that there's an astoundingly powerful and organized double bass section, and say, well, aha, we can really make the bass line still a more dramatic part of the proceedings because the talents and strengths of the section suggest that that might be possible.
And then I'm working with your other two, your day jobs, so to speak, in San Francisco and in Miami. clearly very different approaches there in San Francisco, a group of very well-established musicians, in the New World Symphony, younger players. Mm-hmm. Clearly in San Francisco you have years of working with them and you have, you know, formed them in your own likeness, so to speak. With the New World, it's an ever-changing cast, it's younger musicians. How is the approach in those two different situations?
Well, San Francisco is, of course, very accustomed to the particular things that I tend to ask for, which are usually more extreme than what many of my colleagues may ask for. A lot of conductors do enjoy kind of organizing things and establishing certain limits on things. It's generally my nature to do the opposite. I'm trying to encourage people to kind of color outside the lines and figure out ways in which they could be more soloistic. They could take more chances. In an orchestra, as I've said many times, is a large ensemble of people, and generally in a large number of people, we all try and find some middle ground. We're told that in society and in life, that's good. We find some middle ground on which we can agree, and that's kind of consensus. Well, that, they say, works well in society. Doesn't actually work so well in an orchestra, because then everything is kind of mezzo piano, mezzo forte, not too short, not too long. And the whole idea of what you need to do is to encourage people to go to various kinds of extremes at particular moments. And in the case of something like a Mahler symphony, it means that somebody might have to be playing the most legato tender music while somebody else is just barking or baying at the moon in a quite outrageous fashion. And those elements must coexist with one another because the music is representing different streams of thought or different ideas in the world, as Mahler claimed it did.
And you must be communicating both those ideas simultaneously.
Yes, and also I'm clear at establishing for the orchestra that there are different levels of expression simultaneously occurring, and which is the level in which they at this moment find themselves, and also that there are particular moments in which the whole drama of the piece hinges on what one second clarinetist may do, and that he understands that that is his big moment and that everyone's relying upon him to do something completely out of the box.
Michael Tilson Thomas. He conducts the Philadelphia Orchestra and Aaron Copland Symphony for Organ and Orchestra with soloist Paul Jacobs and Mahler Symphony No. 5 this evening at 8 and tomorrow afternoon at 2 at Verizon Hall at the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Humor has been a hot commodity in this election year. Stand-up comedians, late-night television talk show hosts, fake news programs, and sketch comedies were all in their element, poking fun at and impersonating political candidates. Within all these comedy outlets, something many of the writers and performers share is a background in improvisational theater, or improv. It's a form that's steadily gained in popularity over the past 50 years, and as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, is burgeoning in Philadelphia, as demonstrated by the annual Philadelphia Improv Festival to be held next week.
The festival, which starts on Thursday, will be held at the Plays and Players Theater in Center City, Philadelphia. And according to Matt Nelson, executive producer of the event, the festival's fourth year reflects a surge of improv comedy in Philadelphia.
This year, we have 200 improvisers coming in from around the country and locally, 39 acts across 3 days. So it's really grown. It's definitely a large jump in what we're putting out there.
Nelson estimates that there are now about 20 active Philadelphia-based improv groups, a stark contrast to the scene of the region even 5 years ago, when there was little more than a handful of established troupes. With about 15 years of experience in the theatrical form around the country, Matt Nelson largely attributes Philadelphia's growth in improv to increased awareness of the comedy groups in the region. Many people already appreciated the form, they just didn't know it existed locally. Still, Nelson acknowledges that it is a style of theater that's not deeply familiar to everyone. His description of improvisational theater is simple.
It is, in essence, a scene that exists in the moment, without a script and without predetermination.
Nelson says, though there are many different variations of the unscripted form, there are two main styles, long and short form. A short form show often has a host and consists of a variety of improv games. a series of 2 to 5 minute vignettes with audience input throughout. The seminal British-born television and radio show Whose Line Is It Anyway, which featured some then-unknown American comedians like Wayne Brady and Ryan Stiles, falls under the short-form label. Long-form improv, on the other hand, generally includes an audience suggestion at the top of the show, and then the actors take it from there, making up the plot and dialogue as they go along for a good half hour or so, kind of like a one-act play. For Nelson, the appeal of improv theater is the freedom that it gives an actor, in contrast to more traditional plays.
With improv, it allows you to be anyone at any time, and just anything can happen, and it's really exhilarating experience.
I think that making people laugh is like a drug.
Alexis Simpson is artistic director of the Philly Improv Theater.
It's the best feeling in the world when you are in front of people and they like what you're doing.
Simpson, who has been performing and teaching improv for about 8 years, is also a member of Comedy Sports, a veteran group in Philadelphia, and she's co-founder of The Rare Bird Show, a three-person comedy troupe that was founded in 2003. In preparation for the upcoming festival, the trio, Simpson, Nathan Edmondson, and Matt Holmes, rehearsed this week at the Shubin Theater in Philadelphia.
I should keep going unless I have, like, punchline clear to everybody.
Yeah.
Right.
And I trust you to start.
And I think right. That, like, with
Alexis Simpson says over the years of performing improv, the most common question she's asked is, how do you rehearse improv?
It's just like sports. They practice and they develop muscles and skills and ways of thinking so that on game day you can just suit up and play.
Actors have been suiting up for improv for some time. Vaudeville had elements of improvisation. Actors have long used improv exercises to hone their acting skills, and directors frequently use it in the rehearsal process of plays. But Matt Nelson says that in North America, it emerged as a more formalized, independent form in 1960s Chicago, where it is still very strong.
Chicago certainly is today and probably will remain the improv mecca. That is where it is the most widely understood and realized amongst general audiences.
Following in the footsteps of groups like the Second City Theater in Chicago, improv hubs popped up elsewhere, in New York, Los Angeles, and Toronto. Among the improv groups scattered about, there's a lot of diversity and no hard and fast rules of how improv theater should be conducted. However, there are a handful of shared guiding principles. Chief among them, says Matt Nelson, is that actors should agree with each other on stage.
It's whenever they put something out there, you're fully accepting that reality. So if someone says, I'm a farmer, you don't say, no, you're not, you're a mechanic, because then that's just completely deflated any progress that was about to be made.
Another important ingredient in improv shows is the audience, according to Nathan Edmondson, a member of The Rare Bird Show.
If they jump on board with you, and if you're hitting your scene work really well, it can propel the energy of the entire experience to such levels that you wouldn't even think you could go to.
Conversely, Edmondson says performing can be much harder in front of a small or subdued audience. Edmondson is one of the co-founders of the Philadelphia Improv Festival. When it started 4 years ago, he says he saw the event as a great opportunity to bring in improv groups from around the country and to highlight the Philadelphia talent, with its groups like The N Crowd, Lunch Lady Doris, Tongue and Groove, and Comedy Sports. In cities where improv theater is more established, Edmondson says there are definite local styles. Philadelphia, however, doesn't have one quite yet.
I think Philadelphia is a whole bunch of different people from, a lot from Philly, but people who have gained a whole bunch of information from a whole bunch of different places, and it's kind of been thrown together here.
Edmondson says as a core group of improv performers remain in Philadelphia and spend time and energy honing their skills, a Philly style will emerge. In the meantime, with events like the annual Improv Festival, local comedy groups look to brand Philadelphia as a serious venue.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The Philadelphia Improv Festival opens this Thursday and runs through November 15th at the Plays and Players Theater in Philadelphia. Philadelphia's Broad Street corridor, with its concentration of cultural venues, among them the Academy of Music, the Wilma, Merriam, and Suzanne Roberts Theaters, the Kimmel Center, and the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, is hailed as the Avenue of the Arts. But the city also has an Avenue of the Artists. Known during its history as the Little Street of Clubs, tree-lined cobblestone Camac runs from Walnut to Lombard and is home to two of the oldest clubs for fine artists in the country. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis visits the Sketch Club and the Plastic Club as they carry on their legacies.
Hi, how are you?
Good, Susan. How are you?
Good, thanks. To see
you. Bill Patterson, president of the Sketch Club, welcomes us inside an early 19th century house where artists have been gathering for more than 100 years. The club started on 11th Street in 1860 when six students from the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts wanted to get together to work on their sketching skills.
But then after a while, they had some social events, and they started to realize that they gained artistically from those social exchanges at these events. And so it became more of a social club with a lot of camaraderie that gave artists a chance to network and see what other artists are doing and trade stories.
Art, of course, was the central focus, and workshops met the needs of a growing membership. In the 1870s, when the Pennsylvania Academy was temporarily closed down, a young artist named Thomas Akins taught life classes at the Sketch Club.
When the Academy opened their new building, his followers here petitioned the Academy to have an evening life class and to hire Akins as an instructor. So Akins had his beginning as an instructor here at the Sketch Club.
Other members over the years included painters Thomas Anschutz, Daniel Garber, and N.C. Wyeth. In the early 1900s, the club, with over 400 members, bought three adjoining houses on Camac Street and converted them to one clubhouse with a library and kitchen, space to work in the light-filled studio, which spans the combined second and third floors and also functions as a gallery, and places to unwind, like the basement Rathskeller, with carved chairs pulled up to long tables in front of a big fireplace.
One neat thing you'll see on the beams in here, there are drawings and artists' names and a peg. Here's the name, looks like Pitts, where Pitts would have hung his beer mug.
It was a great gathering place for artists, if they were men. Women artists were not admitted as members.
So they formed their own club.
Artist Betty McDonald is a past president of the originally all-female Plastic Club, which formed in 1897 and in 1910 moved into its clubhouse, also on Camac Street. The Plastic Club joined two houses to create its own upper studio with skylights, a basement tea room, and gallery and meeting space on the first floor. And the name? McDonald says it had nothing to do with what we think of as plastic today.
They used the term plastic art, which meant the malleable, solid art. They didn't want to be known as tea party ladies who appreciated art. They were actually in there with their elbows doing it.
And doing it professionally, as sculptors, painters, illustrators, and muralists. The club boasts among its founding members the three so-called Red Rose girls who met in Howard Pyle's illustration class. Illustrators Jessie Wilcox Smith and Elizabeth Shippen Green, who worked for Ladies' Home Journal and Harper's Magazine, as well as muralist Violet Oakley, who created murals for Pennsylvania's State Capitol Building, Senate, and Supreme Court. The two clubs were male and female counterparts of the same artistic community, one that Betty McDonald grew up in. Her mother, Dorothy Hutton, worked in oils, etchings, and lithographs, and was a member of the Plastic Club, where she'd sometimes bring her daughter.
I used to come and pose, which I hated, because you get itchy when you pose, and you have to sit and be quiet.
Her father, Hugh Hutton, was an illustrator for the Philadelphia Inquirer and a member of the Sketch Club. Betty grew up to become a member and then president of both clubs. Around 1990, both went co-ed.
We let men in, which was a big change. My husband pushed for that. He said it's illegal to exclude men or women.
Today, some people like McDonald belong to both. Each club, though, has its own history and identity. The Plastic Club is low-key, all-volunteer, and focuses on its mission of providing a place for artists to come together to work and share ideas. Its current president is Bob Jackson.
And on the second Tuesday of every month, we have a salon here, and we just sit around and talk about art. We bounce ideas off of each other's heads.
Past president Michael Gwynn likens it to a gym for artists.
You can work out here and get better. And if you are already pretty good, you can stay good. It's a gym. It's for keeping your eye muscles in good shape.
And while Plastic Club members appreciate the over 100-year-old history,
we have no ambition to be important, to have any status. We gave our archives to the Historical Society. You know, they can take care of it. We don't want to spend our time preserving things. We want to be active and be friendly to the artists and let them come in and use the place.
In contrast, the Sketch Club actively preserves and promotes its history, keeping its archives close at hand. The library, ringed with portraits by Thomas Anschutz of members from the 1890s, has books and research materials collected over the years, and a large oil by Hugh Breckenridge of his wife and daughter, shown at the Academy in 1909, hangs prominently at the end of the room. In the last decade, the Sketch Club has taken on an executive director, Barbara Murray, who is working with member volunteers to coordinate a 150th anniversary celebration in 2010. She says art shows help carry on the club's tradition.
The six bohemian artists that began the Sketch Club were very interested in bringing the public into this mysterious world of art.
Down the street, Plastic Club member Alan Claywins is also the new exhibition director.
We have about 9 exhibitions a year here. There are artists from all over the country.
But ultimately, both clubs exist to serve local visual artists, like Bucks County painter and Sketch Club member Alan Fetterman.
It's more and more difficult each and every day to survive exclusively as a fine artist. Not commercial artist, not an illustrator, but a fine artist. It's a hard go. And you have like individuals here, so you can communicate and extend values and exchange ideas.
Today, Philadelphia is a city rich in the arts, with big museums and flashy performing halls and theaters. Yet in the shadow of these modern-day grand gestures that light up Broad Street and the Parkway are a few blocks that recall 19th-century Philadelphia, where artists, many neither rich nor famous, have always had a home.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. A show by the American Color Print Society is at the Plastic Club, and a juried show of abstract works open today at the Sketch Club. Both run through November 30th. Anybody who says that the classical music scene in Philadelphia is traditional and uptight wasn't at last night's concert of the Philadelphia Virtuosi Chamber Orchestra, which moved from its usual headquarters at the First Presbyterian Church off Rittenhouse Square to the Arden Theatre's main stage in Old City. There, the group played its usual Bach and Mozart calling cards and amid a theatrical lighting design went into less-travelled territory, like the Kurt Kobel 7 Variations of Madness, which had its world premiere using mechanical laptop-operated instruments that the composer made himself. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns was at this week's rehearsals.
Going to be a very interesting, exciting world premiere.
Yeah.
Interesting indeed. That's about as specific as anybody could be in advance of the Philadelphia Virtuosi's concert last night, titled On the Edge. Besides writing an unusually jazzy concerto, Kurt Kobel featured a battery of mechanical instruments. Around it, music director Daniel Spalding programmed Steve Reich's triple quartet and Shostakovich's string quartet No. 7 with the musicians distributed around the theater in a sort of live version of surround sound. Whatever one thought of its outcome, it was a template for 21st century concerts.
I love surprising the audience. So we'll be changing the lighting or the colors depending upon the mood of the piece. We've always felt like we wanted to put together a very special program that uses effects that grow organically out of the music.
Spalding's interest in things visual and less than typical has led him to record George Antheil's famously scandalous Ballet Mécanique for Naxos Records, which could be heard as a forerunner to what Kurt Kobel is up to. Not that everything Spalding does is radical. He also constructs programs around film scores such as the piano concerto drawn from Alfred Hitchcock's film Spellbound to this chamber orchestra version of The French Lieutenant's Woman. That, plus the orchestra's signature works by Bach and Mozart, create wide-ranging programs that defy a simple marketing buzzword. Also, the orchestra hasn't always been easy to find. The Philadelphia Virtuosi have often been a road orchestra, touring up to 3,000 miles across North America, sometimes being heard outside of Philadelphia more than in. But that's the price of freedom, which is what prompted Spalding to form the orchestra in 1991. Though he does some guest conducting in Eastern Europe, Spalding concentrates a huge amount of energy on the uphill battle of playing in Philadelphia, often devising projects and worrying about the price tag later. So it was with last night's concert, which cost $40,000.
I wonder how we do it sometimes, because it seems like we're always on the brink. We are on the edge, ready to go off the cliff at any moment. Somehow we pull it off. It's just a hell of a lot of hard work.
Imagine the difficulty were Spalding running a larger group of explaining Kobol's partially artificial musicians to your typical board of directors. The Kobol is a violinist who has played in the orchestra pit of Broadway's ultra-mainstream Phantom of the Opera over the past 15 years. He began to wonder, night after night, if mechanical instruments like the player piano could be taken into the age of ever higher technology. At the rehearsal I visited, there was a conventional violin being played by two mechanical bows simultaneously, with all sorts of wires running into Kurt Kobol's laptop computer.
I'm a self-proclaimed obscure composer, and I write unpopular music. And essentially, I am completely free when it comes to composing. I don't align with any particular school or philosophy. Is very satisfying. So it on the one hand, I guess it does have a bit of self-indulgence, but on the other hand, it's that American spirit of exploration.
The philosophy sounds impressive, but what does the music sound like?
I'd play something like this.
What we're hearing is a velocity of music that's actually much faster than the human ear can parse. The combination of two bows plus a complete lack of flesh and blood limitations creates clouds of music that pulsate in ways that perhaps no other sound can. You have to commend the Philadelphia Virtuosi for taking a leap of faith on this, because it's hard to say what the audience reaction would be. Witnessing these strange mechanisms creating high-energy art without sweat or even heat or even any conventional sense of humanity easily taps into one's fears of computers taking over the world. Yet these contraptions also recapture a sense of fun when, in your long-ago childhood, a new, previously unimaginable toy suddenly made you very, very happy. What other music brings such intense extremes of fascination and revulsion?
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. He wrote about Philadelphia Virtuosi in Thursday's paper. That's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.